Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I mean, like, the reality is now sinking in, right? That Tom Brady truly is a Buccaneer. That's a real thing. And now that the reality is sinking in, the stories are starting to come out. The ones from New England about what happened there, and the ones from Tampa about how they shocked the world and landed TB43. But why don't we start in New England and all that weirdness that led to his departure? Like this detail from Seth Wickersham's piece over the weekend. Quote, after the Super Bowl, Brady was back in Boston in a house his family had largely emptied out. He was acting on his own, quietly putting out feelers, leaving owners and executives to wonder whether he had a free agency plan. The quote goes on. To many of the executives who did due diligence, Brady seemed to be driven by an animus toward Belichick that they couldn't tell if he actually wanted a fresh start or if he just needed leverage to force Kraft to step in. End quote. I mean, damn, what a weird, weird image that is. A really bizarre image. The best quarterback in NFL history. Kicking around in an empty house, quote, driven by an animus toward Belichick. Not driven to show that he could still play at the highest level. Not driven to show that he could still get it done and still wanted to. No, driven by hatred of the hood. Now that's the kind of rocket fuel I'm talking about. He's not looking to prove anybody right. He's looking to prove Belichick all wrong. You know that whole thing about business being business, that it's not personal, it's never personal, it's just business. I'm just going to go ahead and call bullcrap on that right now, because it's always personal with the very best. And if Brady truly is the GOAT, you can bet your ass this is personal to him. And I've got no problem with it. In fact, I actually love it. He would never say it, but you know that old man is salty as hell. Why wouldn't he be? After six rings, all the guy was looking for was fair market value, an attaboy or two, and some help on the outside. Not too much to ask for, given what he's done for that coach, given what he's done for that organization, given what he's done for that fan base. To read Wickersham, it seemed pretty clear that as of last week, when that rolled around, Brady was leaving because whatever he was looking for, he was not going to get from the Patriots. That said, it still seems like Bob Kraft was the last guy to know that, which is either Kraft putting up a front or Kraft being completely out to lunch. Because when Brady went to Kraft's house on Monday night, he was going to tell him that he was leaving. Except, as Kraft told NBC Sports Boston, quote, I thought he was coming over, as he has for the last 10 years, to quietly get things done. End quote. Really, Bob? Seriously, dude, are you that out of touch? Did you really misjudge that situation that badly? Or are you just trying to cover it up to make it look better? Are you just trying to cover your own backside to make it look good? I mean, there's no way you actually thought this guy was going to work out a deal with you that night, right? There's no way you expect any of us to believe that, right? And if you thought that statement was strange from Kraft, check this one out. Check out the one he told NFL Network later on. Quote, think about loving your wife, and for whatever reason, there's something, her father, her mother, that makes life impossible for you, and you have to move on. End quote. Huh? That's your explanation for what happened. Man, Jerry Jones is laughing at your analogies, Bob.
Picture if you were a driver of a car, and you had a wreck, and your hand was almost severed off, but you didn't understand your anatomy. You look down. You're spurting blood, you open the door and run to the woods and either die bleeding to death or shock. The educated man looks down, knows his anatomy, squeezes and knows his best chance is to wait for help. That's because he's been there a lot and done that. And so I'm waiting, I'm squeezing and waiting for help.
Kraft has got to be like, yeah, 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 I see a working chair. Yeah, yeah, I get it. Get back to Kraft for a minute. Like, who is the wife here? Who is the father here? Who is the mother? Hey, Bob, I thought you loved Brady like a son. Or was it a grandson? And is Belichick your actual son? What the hell is happening with this family tree? Again, how could the owner of the franchise, the guy who was allegedly calling all the shots, have been that far off base and that out of touch as he's claiming to be. Man, no wonder Brady left. The owner is utterly clueless, and the coach has got the biggest red ass ever. But, I want to keep things lighter. I want to keep things happier. Why don't we go down to Tampa and see the positive side of this? Let's be a little more upbeat. Let's be a little more optimistic. Let's talk about the very first request that Brady made of his new team. Because that tells you pretty much everything you need to know about him. Allegedly. According to the Tampa Bay Times, last Wednesday's phone call between Brady and the Bucks lasted about an hour and a half, and Brady did most of the talking. He knew about the offense. He knew the players at each position. He didn't want to know about Mike Evans and Chris Godwin as players. He asked, quote, "Are they good guys?" End quote. He didn't ask the team for money. Nope, didn't do that. Didn't want control. Didn't want money. Didn't want a huge say in things. He only asked for one thing, apparently. Are you ready for this? He only wanted one thing. Are you ready? Nope, it was not the number 12 jersey. Nope, it was not a demand to return to either the Buccaneer Bruce or Pewter Power Unis. Nope. You know what it was? You can just go ahead and wait for it. And now you can wait a little longer. A little longer. Tom Brady asked the Bucks for the phone numbers of his new teammates. Shut it down. Let's go home.
Let's go.
Are you freaking kidding me? He went there. He asked for his teammates' phone numbers. What a bleeping leader. Man, you want to talk about leading from the front. Holy crap. He did that. He went there. Hey, did the Bucks just sign Tom Brady or Winston Churchill? Julius Caesar, scoreboard. Look up at it, dog. This guy is the greatest teammate ever. Holy crap. He's not just the greatest quarterback ever. He's the greatest human being ever. Tom Brady is like Tim Tebow if Tim Tebow could play football. He asked for their phone numbers. Man, what a legend. What an amazing dude. Who the hell even thinks to do that, much less actually does that? Wow, man. TB43. Hey, look, I'm not here to hate, but forgive me if I don't rush in to erect a statue for the guy because he asked for his teammates' phone numbers. Doesn't make him some kind of legendary leader. That just means he wants to communicate with his new teammates, you know, like any other normal player would do. In fact, how big of a jerk would you have to be? How much of a jerk quarterback would you have to be to sign with a new team and not look to be in touch with your teammates? What kind of a loser would just say, nah, I'm good. Nah, I don't want their numbers. Nah, if they want me, they know where to find me. And I'm not sure I'd really be giving him a pat on the back for knowing the offense either, or being able to name the players by position as well. That's just doing your homework or having a depth chart in front of you while you're on the phone. Smart, I guess. Normal. Look, if you're going to leave your home the past 20 years, most people would look into the place that they want to go to. You know, maybe throw on some game film, see if that team's any good, maybe see if it's a good fit, maybe see if there's any talent, maybe get a basic idea of what offense they run there. Tom Brady, knowing the names of the guys on the offense, and then talking just a little bit about that improving defense, does not make him a great leader. It doesn't prove that he's this unbelievable leader. It proves the guy has a laptop. Let me be clear. Tom Brady is a great quarterback. Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback ever. The six Super Bowls that he has won prove that. Asking for his teammates' phone numbers does not. No credit for that. Or for having a basic understanding of the roster and what they're trying to do there. TB43 deserves credit for a lot of things, just not for any of that. Stop making this guy out to be some hero. Man, you won't believe what he asked for. The guy only wanted one thing. Digits. Right. Just like every other quarterback in the history of the world would have wanted if they were going to a new situation. Digits. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Then don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and it's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business that takes smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned is sweetened with a touch of brown sugar goodness, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy for those of you who like to take things up a notch. So, the next time you want a great protein, an energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Myron Roll is my guest. Myron, so nice to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Jim. Appreciate
it's good
it.
To have you. Thank you so much. In fact, there's so much I want to talk to you about, but before we get into everything, how are you and your family holding up? How are things?
You know, it's pretty chaotic around here right now. Obviously, our hospital is one of the largest hospitals in the East Coast, and 1,000-bed hospital with so many people coming from Maine, New Hampshire, all over the country to be seen and treated here in Boston. And, you know, our equipment's low and our staff is overworked and overwhelmed right now. Our neurosurgical floor, we transferred a lot of our patients either to rehab facilities quickly or to other floors because we're reserving floors for COVID-19 patients because the influx has been ridiculous. So it's really hectic right now, but we're holding steady and we're trying to stay safe on our own and trying to do the best we can.
Myron Rowe is joining us. I can appreciate that response, and I'm going to follow up on some of that. Let me ask you this. Back in February, you tweeted in part, quote, "Several instruments fire me up in our neurological unit as much as the sauna pet." What exactly is that, and how does that work? What kind of an impact has that had on you as a doctor?
Oh, man, it's amazing. So we have some amazing brain tumor specialists here. And, I'm actually going into pediatric neurosurgery, but there are a lot of pediatric brain tumors that I'll be kind of tackling as I go on in my career. But I was working on an adult with a benign tumor, meningioma, in the convexity, so sort of near the surface of the brain, and was causing some seizures and some pain. So the Sonopet is basically this ultrasound, high-aspirating instrument that you basically just core out the middle of the tumor, and it eviscerates the tumor right in front of your eyes, and then the tumor sort of falls in and of itself. So if you core out the middle part, the edges sort of just like come towards you and just crumble, and then you can peel away the edges from the vessels that are sort of feeding into the meningioma and take it all out. It is amazing. It's like magic. It not only increases the expediency of the surgery, but it also just gets great results. I just love it. And whenever I have it in my hand, I'm like, I feel like a boss. I feel like a wand from Harry Potter. It's great.
Amazing. Myron Rowe is joining us. What an amazing description. And then back in November, you tweeted in part, quote, "Today I was led through two awesome spine operations by my attending doctor," end quote. What was that experience like?
Well, that was amazing because, you know, these are two cases of people who had, serious significant neck pain and also some radicular symptoms. They have trouble walking, and they were just very uncomfortable. And they had radiographic findings of stenosis of their spinal cord that was causing these symptoms. And my attending is a young guy, and he's very, very, education-focused. And he just walked me through each step, you know, and challenged me, okay, what do you want to do next? Okay, what if this happens? What do you do? What if this happens? What do you do? It put me back into being a football player, as if a receiver comes out and, you know, their split is, you know, right near the hash marks. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, I wasn't expecting him to come out here, but he can run this route or that route or this route. And so you just had to think about all the options that are available to you. And that was the first time, I think, in the operating room where I really felt like I was going through the steps of option 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and coming out successful on the other end of it. So it was great.
I would imagine going through the progressions there is very different. Myron Rowe is joining us. So, Myron, what's it mean to you and your department if there's an influx of patients? For instance, does that mean that some of the neurological cases would have to be postponed or delayed to free up resources for COVID patients? How does that work?
Yes, you're absolutely right. So our elective cases have been either canceled or postponed. Our clinics have been done virtually. So we just call up our patients. So we do like Zoom, you know, video conferences to try to tell our patients, hey, you know, how you doing? You know, I'm looking at your scan. It looks okay. so you don't get that in-person feel anymore. And then some of our ICUs and some of our operating rooms actually are soon to be transformed into, you know, beds actually, like rooms for people who need oxygen support and supplementation. So it is, you know, my whole sort of you know, day-to-day life now as a neurosurgeon has been transformed by this. And I don't mind it, honestly, because I know this is a very pressing issue and everybody has to be involved. Everybody has to play a role. And as surgeons, if we can do anything possible to help our hospital, help our patient population, then we'll do that. And that's what we've been at.
And thank you so much for that. Let me ask you this. How do you go about making sure that you are safe and you are protected in the hospital at this time?
Yeah, another great question. You know, we have these masks that our hospital is now requiring everyone to wear, the surgical mask. But there's also the N95 sort of special protection mask that I would put on going into a patient's room. I make sure I wash my hands thoroughly all the time. I already do that as a neurosurgeon resident. So, you know, I'm always washing my hands, but now it's even closer attention to detail than I had before. I glove up all the time. I put gowns on. I make sure that when I take off all those things, when I leave the room, I take them off in a sterile and proper fashion. And then when I leave the hospital, I make sure I take off my scrub before I come home. So, you know, it's important to protect myself and my family so that I and other people are able to, as healthcare workers, we're able to be valuable to the fight against COVID-19 right now, for sure.
He is a neurosurgeon, Myron Rolla, joining us for a few more moments. You know, Myron, if I were to go back to last year when Hurricane Dorian was heading to the Bahamas, what kind of emotions were you feeling as you watched that entire thing unfold?
Oh, my goodness. As you know, I'm from the Bahamas, and it was hard. You know, being up here in the ivory towers of Harvard and, you know, all these intellectual giants, and then getting WhatsApp messages from my family saying that, you know, the house is destroyed and they can't find their neighbor and, you know, they're up in the attic and, you know, everything's shut down. It was tough. So I called up my president of our hospital, Peter Slavin, and asked him, you know, what can I do? You know, is there any team from Mass General Hospital headed down to the Bahamas? He put me in contact with some people who are going down. I asked my chairman, Bob Carter, here in neurosurgery if I could go. He said, absolutely. I went down there. Didn't do any neurosurgery, didn't do any brain or spine surgery, but I was able to help sort of in an urgent care, primary care setting for some of my homeland people. And it was great. It felt wonderful to be able to have an impact and to come home as sort of a, you know, a son of the soil and, you know, just create change that way. So it was a good experience, and our country is still rebuilding, but it was good.
Yeah, I would imagine. It would seem to me that it would be so hard to have an experience like that and not have it have a lasting impact on you. How much did it stay with you even after you did return to Boston?
You know, it stayed with me a lot, honestly. I mean, I made a presentation in front of our department speaking about the efforts. I continuously talk about it on my social media platforms, how our country is still rebuilding. My parents are still rebuilding some of their homes. My aunts and uncles are doing the same. But you know what it does, Jim, for me, honestly, it gives me faith in the people of the Bahamas and just people in general. When tragedy hits, unfortunately, sometimes you can either run or you can step forward. And I feel like our country really stepped forward and band together as a unit and looked in solidarity, prayed together, housed people who were coming from Abaco or Grand Bahama without homes, you know, fed people who didn't have their homes. You know, it was just a wonderful display and expression of the goodness of human nature. And it's unfortunate, again, that a tragedy has to bring that out of us, but it did, and I'm proud. And I plan on going back, you know, in a couple months or so, once all this stuff sort of settles out with COVID-19, just check on my family and make sure that we're still progressing in the right direction.
Myron, you're a reassuring voice. It's a reassuring message, to be sure. Before I let you go, last year you were selected as a Harvard Paul Farmer Global Surgery Research Fellow. What did it mean to you to receive that honor, and what does that mean for your work going forward?
Yeah, so, you know, it's wonderful. Matter of fact, when I was actually applying for the Rhodes Scholarship, I read a book called Mountains Beyond Mountains by Tracy Kidder. It chronicled the life of Paul Farmer. And, you know, his story, going to Haiti, coming from Harvard, going to Haiti and shooting, you know, the vulnerable populations down there was certainly inspiring for me. And the reason why, actually, that I went into medical anthropology at Oxford, that's where I studied. And, you know, looks at the social and cultural aspects of medicine. So in our fourth and fifth year of residency here at Mass General, we're able to, you know, research and do what we want. And a couple of my colleagues are going into the lab and doing basic science, but I wanted to do global surgery, global neurosurgery. I want to take what we have here, the resources and the knowledge and the skills that I have in America, and bring those to other parts of the world that may not ever touch a neurosurgeon. So I'll be able to go to Uganda and Zambia and some other parts of sub-Saharan Africa and deliver treatment to a pediatric neurosurgical population, kids who have big heads, hydrocephalus, or have spina bifida, or have some sort of, you know, really bad neurosurgical disease burden. And the Paul Farmer Global Surgery Fellowship sort of provides a vehicle for me to go into these vulnerable and disenfranchised communities and treat. And then ultimately get to go back to the Bahamas and, you know, provide care for, you know, my family and loved ones there. So it's a wonderful opportunity. Harvard is bustling with resources, and I just want to take advantage of it. As a kid from Florida State, you know, I just came up here to this Ivy League and was like, hey, this is available. Let's go after it. Let's get it done.
You know, as a kid from Florida State, since you mentioned that, let me finally ask you this before I let you go. You and I have talked so many times over the years. Going back to your playing career, you've always struck me as somebody who had a plan and a vision. So is this the life that you envisioned, or could you make the argument that this is even better and more impactful than you could have ever envisioned?
You know, now I think it's certainly much more impactful, for sure. If you had asked me back then when you and I were talking a lot, you know, when I was playing at FSU, Bobby Bowden, you know, Garden Gold, I was like, man, I want to play for 10 years in the NFL. You know, I want to go to the Super Bowl, be a Pro Bowler. You know, I only played 3 years in the NFL and, you know, didn't really get a lot of playing time on the field in and of itself. But I'm you know, grateful that that actually happened as I look back on it, because my hands were spared. I'm able to physically do surgeries in the operating room. I did not have any concussions or any lasting traumatic brain injury, so I'm able to think through some of the problems that are presented to me daily. And now I'm able to have an impact and a reach on people and save lives, thankfully, with the help of, you know, fellow doctors and nurses and staff here at Mass General. So I think it's worked out very well. I'm excited. Just going to continue to grow. And hopefully, you know, even though football has left me physically, I can't play it anymore. But if there's a way that I can, you know, have a foot into the game to help with traumatic brain injury and concussions, and sort of give sort of a perspective from a medical perspective or someone who played the game, I'd love to do that too. So I'm keeping that option open as well, for sure.
And wouldn't that be great? A neurosurgeon at Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, a Rhodes Scholar. Myron Roll is my guest. As I mentioned, Myron, it's a really reassuring message, and you are a reassuring voice. So good to have you back on, and thank you so much for doing it.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate you, man.
So, of course, the biggest question right now in New England is, what are they going to do to replace Tom Brady? What's the plan? I mean, they had to know that this could happen. You can't just walk out on the street and find some amazing leader of men who will ask for his teammates' phone numbers at a new opportunity. Dudes like that don't grow on trees. How are you going to replace that? How do you go about replacing that guy? What do you do? Do you go to Jameis Winston? Do you go to Andy Dalton? Do you wait and see if Cam Newton is healthy and think about what he might mean for that offense? Nope. Apparently what you do, now, Alvy, I'm going to need some hype music for this. Apparently what you do and who you go with is Brian Hoyer. No. Correction. Brian. Axel. Hoyer. Hell yes. That's how you do it. Replace the GOAT with the Hoyer. The Patriots have signed Brian Hoyer to return to New England for his third stint with that team. Meaning they didn't even need to have him or wait for him to ask for his teammates' telephone numbers, because he already has them. And it means that Jarrett Stidham, who beat out Brian Hoyer last year for the backup job, is going to have to do it again. But this time, apparently, for the starting job. And if that two-headed monster of Stidham and Hoyer were not enough to get fans fired up and to get them to forget about TB43, there is a third man in this cage fight. Cody Kessler. So as of this very moment, the Pats are going to replace Tom Brady with Jarrett Stidham, Brian Hoyer, or Cody Kessler. I mean, holy crap, that's your plan, Hood. That's what you're going with. Good luck with that. With all due respect to those three guys, and whenever somebody says, with all due respect, somebody is about to get disrespected. In this case, all three guys are. But even if you were to somehow figure out a way to combine all three of these guys, Stidham, Hoyer, Kessler, and then maybe even stack them on top of each other to make some sort of insane 18-foot-tall quarterback, that beast still would not be better than Brady of last year. And Brady of last year was not great. Like, if I didn't know any better, I would say that was a quarterback room that was looking to tank for Trevor Lawrence. And yes, yes, I do know what Matt Castle and Jimmy G did when they filled in for Brady back in the day. And I know that the Pats are really high on Stidham and that Hoyer really knows that system. But I mean, come on. Seriously? Going with that crew is really testing the theory that they don't need Tom Brady. It's almost like they're trying to punk Brady with that depth chart. You think you're so great. You think you're so great, Mr. I ask for my new teammates' phone numbers. You think we can't win without you. Yeah, watch this. Watch us win with a couple of journeymen and a fourth-round pick who's thrown four passes in his career. And you know what? You know what the most Belichick thing ever would be? Belichick taking that Frankenstein monster of a depth chart to another divisional title and the Super Bowl and playing that Super Bowl in Tom's new house in Tampa. That would be the most Belichickian thing ever. Except, let's be real, even for Belichick, that is a major stretch. Yeah, but fear not, Patriot fans. There is a report that New England is looking at the draft as well. So this might not be the three they're going with. Because you got to admit, this is a really interesting draft in terms of quarterbacks. So, if they're looking to get a quarterback in the draft, who might that be? Are they looking to take a shot and move up and maybe get Tua or Justin Herbert? Maybe bet on the talent of a Jordan Love? Any of those three guys? No, no, and no, because according to Aaron Wilson of the Houston Chronicle, the Pats are one of the teams who are doing extra work and their due diligence on James Morgan of FIU. Once again, hell yes. That has to ease the concerns of every single Patriots fan. Brady is gone, but we got the guy from Florida International University. Problem solved. On behalf of former President Madik.
On behalf of President Madik.
I'd be so pumped to see that happen. Here's the bigger thing for the Pats, though. If going with Stidham, Hoyer, and Kessler sounds like a rebuild, it's because that's what that is. It's because for the first time in a long time, the Patriots are not anywhere near competing for a Super Bowl this year. And it's not just about Brady leaving. Courtesy of Tom Curran, well, and me, I added a few names to this list. Here's a quick summary of the talent drain in New England over the past 2 years. The last 2 years alone. Brady, Gronk, Kyle Van Noy, Trey Flowers, Danny Amendola, Brandon Cooks, Nate Solder, Jamie Collins, Josh Gordon, Trent Brown, Malcolm Butler, even Antonio Brown. That is like a mass exodus of talent. Some of it for good reasons. Maybe they didn't or won't go on to dominate where they end up, right? But they were important members of successful Pats teams. These were guys who made a real difference in that program. And now they're gone. And that doesn't include three coordinators who went on to be head coaches. Brian Flores, Joe Judge, Matt Patricia, and a number of other coaches, as well as contributing players. Again, like Belichick's a genius, and he's getting exactly what he wants right now. He didn't want Brady, so he's getting a life without Brady. But what that means is it's a life with Stidham, Hoyer, and Kessler. Just as Matt Patricia and Bill O'Brien are not Bill Belichick, Bill Belichick's not either of those guys. I get that. He's moved on from talent and still found a way to win with replacement parts. I get that. He is the MacGyver of the NFL. He's rebuilt that plane in the air with whatever he's had in his pockets for the past two decades. Except now that plane feels like it doesn't have any actual parts. Now my man's got to keep that plane in the air with duct tape and chewing gum. The Patriots have always had this image of a team that's done more with less, but this Pats team is going to have to do a lot more with a lot less, and it's hard to see it happening. Who's your quarterback? And don't tell me it doesn't matter as long as you have Belichick. It does. It does. It's a good tune, though, right? Pretty snappy. Jarrell Casey is my guest. Jarrell, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Man, it's a blessing and an honor, man. I'm blessed. I can't ask for nothing else in this time of world, man.
My man, what a great.
How you doing today?
I'm great. I love that response. That is a great, great response. So it's been a couple of days since that trade went down. How does it feel then to be a member of the Denver Broncos?
Man, it felt amazing. It's all I can ask for, you know, especially, like I'm saying, in this time of day, free agency, of how crazy this world can be. I would have never thought I would have been traded. Can't lie about that, but... you know, I'm actually excited that I'm able to be traded and didn't hit free agency, where teams could have, you know, passed up on me and not took the credibility of what I've done the last couple of years. Just blessed that the Broncos, the organization, they seen high hopes in me, and they understand what I can bring to the table, and they trust in my work, and they're ready for me to come in and, you know, help the organization out and build team chemistry and family atmosphere around there.
I want to get into all that in just 1 minute. Jarrell Casey is my guest. One more part, though, about the business. Like, you know, the NFL is a business, and you know things will happen, and they could happen to pretty much everybody, and they will. But at the same time, what's your reaction when you hear you've been traded by the team that drafted you nearly 9 years ago?
Oh, man, you definitely take it by surprise. At the end of the day, you're shocked. Head starts spinning a little bit, kind of trying to figure out what the heck going on, because if I'm not mistaken, I had a pretty good solid year last year. Probably wasn't the best, but coming off injury, I think it was pretty solid. So for something like that to happen after that type of year, you will think that, you know, with the organization you've been with for a while, they give you another chance to prove what you can do, what they know you can do. But like you say, this game is a business, and we all understand how it works. If they feel your production is going down, they're gonna want compensation for that. So they feel what was best for their organization, and you know, I'm glad that the Broncos picked me up, because I understand that this is gonna be best for my career. You know, to get me where I need to be, Hall of Fame wise, to be able to compete for a championship at a high level. This is a great organization for that.
Jarrell Casey joining us. All right, so to that very point, you're going to join a defense that has guys like Von Miller and Bradley Chubb. What do you think about when you think about that, and how do you see yourself fitting in?
Unlimited opportunity to hit the quarterback at your will. That's what I think about. When you got guys that can rush off the edge, that can push the quarterback into the pocket, that can pull away double teams, man, you got to be in heaven. And that's all I keep thinking about, is just the amount of opportunities I have one-on-ones to get a chance to bury a quarterback and put them in the dirt. And that's all that's been racing through my mind. And understanding these guys is high competitors, just watching them on film, watching them throughout the years, they're great rushers. And like I said, that's all I can ask for. Been new to an organization that, you know, looking for pass rushers.
Jarrell Casey, my guest. You know what? That was so descriptive, the way you said what it's like to put a quarterback in the dirt. Kind of lay that out for me. When you consider all the work that goes into it and all the things that have to work out for you to make that play, what does it feel like when you get home and you put a quarterback in the dirt?
Oh, man. The joy that you get in your body, I swear, every time I hit it, I get the chills. Like, some people, they get super excited and they get juice. I feel the chills run through my body every time I hit a quarterback. It's just a adrenaline that you can't really explain. And when you get to that sideline, the smile, I always tell people, man, you could be having a terrible game, and once you get a sack in the game, man, I feel like every problem that you didn't have that day then went away. And that's the best feeling that you can have playing, being a defensive lineman, trying to get out their quarterback.
So are they all nameless and faceless to you? Is it all the same, the quarterback? Or are there certain quarterbacks that when you hit, it feels even better?
Nah. Every quarterback, every opponent, backup, starter, whoever's back there, if I get my arms around you, feel these pads up against your chest, and hear you make a gasping sound, it's all the same to me.
Joe, what's that sound like when a quarterback gasps?
Oh! Like that sound right there, man, is just unbelievable. It's unbelievable, man, when you hear a quarterback get up from that pain. It's actually surprising that they get up from a hit like that, but, you know, to be able to go back and hit them again and hit it again and hear that noise and, you know, and those sacks just keep stacking up, man. It's an unbelievable feeling.
Denver Bronco, Jarrell Casey is my guest. You know, something is, it's one thing for them to incorporate you into that scheme, but the thing that keeps coming up from guys who have played with you and people who've covered you in the past is your ability to raise the intensity of everybody around you, to raise the intensity of the entire team and bring out the best in those on the team. How do you go about doing that?
My biggest thing is I'm a person, like, I compete and I challenge everyone to the max. I'm a guy in practice when I see all wide receivers lined up a certain way. I see guys doing things a certain type of way. I'm a person, I'm going to come at you and I'm going to tell you, hey, you're doing this a little wrong. You're doing that a little wrong. And so, you know, you're holding people accountable. And when you're holding people accountable and you're doing your job, it brings that intensity up because now they want to hold you accountable. They're now waiting for you to mess up because they want to say something to you. And when you're constantly still doing what you're doing consistently and consistently, it makes people say, damn, I can't catch him. So I got to keep improving because I don't want to hear his mouth no more. And, you know, it's not me yelling at him. It's not me cussing him out. It's more so me just, you know, hey, that's not how we're doing it. That's not how we're going to do it today. And, you know, when they understand that, man, it just holds everybody to that accountableness and everybody's ready to roll.
Yeah, who were some of the guys that did that to you when you were a young guy coming up?
Actually, nobody did that to me. That was the surprising part when I got in the league, and that made me take on an approach. First, when I came in, a lot of guys was more so me guys. A lot of guys wasn't necessarily trying to lift the next guy up. They're trying to get it for themselves. And when I came in, I always said, man, your team can't improve if it's not everybody improving. You could always be getting, you know, be improving. You can be making the multiple Pro Bowls. You can be doing what, but the players around you not developing, man, all that stuff is a waste because you're not putting yourself in the run for a playoff. You're not putting yourself in the run for a championship game. So my thing is always trying to bring those guys to the same level you're at. You know, you want everybody playing at a Pro Bowl level, and the only way you can do that is holding yourself accountable at a high level and letting those guys see it.
You know, I think anybody listening right now, like, I can feel the energy, I can feel the desire and the determination, but it's going to be a really unusual offseason in the sense that because of COVID-19, players are not allowed to go to the team facilities. So how do you go about staying in shape and making sure that you're ready to roll when everything does start up again?
Man, you have to just keep on improvising. There's always time to work out. That's all we have is time to work out. So you can find those times right now. Like, and right when I got off this phone, me and my family, I invited everybody over today. We all at my mom's house down here in Long Beach, and we about to hit it in the backyard. We about to take the driveway, turn it into a workout obstacle, and find workouts to do. You want to just bring people around you, and it's a great time for you to encourage your family members that don't work out, you know, to get out there and start working out with you and do things like that. So we're just taking advantage of it, having fun. We're gonna go play a little hoop later at the play some basketball at the park a little later. It's just get yourself out and try to stay away family. As long as all y'all clean and healthy, and they not going around nobody. Try to find that time to keep yourself and your family active as possible.
Listen, before I turn you loose to the family, I'm glad you mentioned the LBC, because even if you did not, I was going to. What was it like to grow up in Long Beach? And then in terms of your football background, what was it like to play at the football factory that is Long Beach Poly, one of the best?
Man, it was unbelievable. Growing up in Long Beach teaches a lot. It teaches you how to become a man early. It teaches you how to take responsibility early. A lot of kids and people around this neighborhood, we grew up in single-family homes. And that's all we know is trying to grow up fast and trying to provide for one another and try to make sure you're doing what's right. And, you know, if anybody know about Long Beach, it's a very high gang-infested area. So you kind of want to try to keep yourself away from that as much as you can and going on the right path. And I should say thank you to my mom, my family, and my brother for leading me on that right direction to get me to where I'm at today. But, you know, being able to go to Long Beach Poly, man, that's every kid's dream from Long Beach. If you didn't go to Poly, you went to another school talking about Poly. And, you know, to be able to win championship after championships, and that just want to make you, you know, get to that next level and understand the value of winning, especially coming from an organization like Long Beach Poly. So for me to be able to get with an organization like the Broncos that knows winning, won a Super Bowl a few years ago, that's all you can ask for, to get back with a championship organization.
Well, I married somebody who went to Poly, so I understand that Poly thing really, really well. Nothing but respect.
There we go.
That's an amazing school. It's an amazing school academically. It's an amazing school athletically. One last thought. I did mention off the top that you're a two-time Titans Walter Payton Man of the Year. Nashville is a community that you and your wife and your family have invested in so much. It means so much to you. How do you go about processing that and then start to develop relationships that are similar to that in Denver when you get there? Is that the plan?
Definitely is the plan. Definitely is a hard process because, like you said, you build so many relationships out there, coaching relationships, not even just for foundation work and charity work. You grow a relationship with the people that work there and build a relationship of friendship and family. And when you leave that, it makes it hard. So the reach out and the text messages and the DMs that I've been getting from the people from the organization, people from the city, has definitely been amazing. My biggest thing is it doesn't stop. No matter, you know, going to Denver, going to Long Beach, going wherever I'm going to head to later in the future, it doesn't stop. My relationship with Nashville, the community will always be there. I'll continue to do my work. And now I'm building in Denver. Big Thing is just going to be hitting it hard, getting right into the community, getting out there, meeting the people, getting to understand what they need. That's going to be the biggest thing, getting to understand what they need and see what I can bring to the city to make help and change and make the life a little bit easier for the Broncos out there. But at the end of the day, my goal is just to make sure, you know, I'm being true to myself, and that's all I can ask for.
It is a great message. He is a five-time Pro Bowl selection and one of just 10 active players to have seven straight seasons with at least five sacks and a new opportunity in Denver. Jarrell Casey, my guest. Jarrell, I appreciate you so much. I'm going to turn you loose to your family. Great to have you back on the show, and thank you very much. That's the kind of energy we all needed today.
Thank you. You have a great one.
And we work in a standalone building. It's only us, the four of us, right now. 1-800-636-8686. It does not mean we will be here forever. We're just going day to day, and right here we are here, and it's good to be here. So if you just want to lay out and listen and let me help you spin clock because you're doing the responsible thing, I'm glad to do it. If you want to participate, maybe you've heard the show for a long time or watched the show but never got around to it, now would be a good time to give it a shot too. You have your phone number, and you can find me on Twitter, and you can also shoot me an email. In the meantime, we are doing the things that we normally do, the three-hour show, the Jim Rohn podcast on Wednesday, and we are still exploring any and all opportunities. Now you know. All right, so another topic for you. And not so surprisingly, it is Patriots-related. The Ballad of One, Robert James Gronkowski. It's kind of been less than a ballad, though, right? Less of a ballad and more of a 160 BPM techno dance anthem when you think about Gronk. I mean, think about the 31 years that Gronk has been orbiting the sun. Think about this for a minute. Gronk is retired from his first gig as one of the best to ever do it. And he put three rings on his oversized digits in the process and yet seamlessly transitioned from professional football meathead to professional TV meathead. And I say that with the utmost respect for this guy. Utmost respect. That's not a backhanded compliment. That's a straight compliment. It's not easy to go from a lifetime athlete to anything else unless you have a plan and you work that plan and you start working that plan early. But Gronk is making it look easy. Gronk is making it look effortless. Mainly because, and I think it's not so much that he had a plan or he worked his plan, mainly because I think what Gronk is doing is rolling out of the rack every single morning and just being himself. And people love him for it. And executives with deep pocketbooks are rushing in to pay him for it. You see, maybe this guy's not a meathead at all. Maybe this guy is the smartest guy in the room. After all, it is the same dude who had his own cruise party while playing for the Patriots, who are the literal antithesis of a cruise party.
I'm trying to get laid.
You're trying to get laid?
Yeah.
So why are you on the Gronk cruise?
To sleep with Gronk.
But you understand that's tough. That's going to be tough.
It might be tough because there's like way hotter chicks than me, but I'm hoping I'm a little bit more freaky than them.
All right, so if that guy was throwing those kind of ragers, not only as a player, but as a member of the Patriots, you can only imagine what his post-playing days were going to look like. And so far, it's gone exactly to script. There was the New Year's Eve party this year on Fox, where Gronk spike-smashed a life-sized Lego bust of his co-host, Steve Harvey.
What are you doing? Are you serious? I don't want to work with him no more. Why is he here? Why are you here? What is wrong with you? You're mentally imbalanced.
Why is he here? Why? Why ask why? You know the answer to that, my man. Acting like a bull in a Lego shop is not surprising. My man Steve Harvey, let me tell you about Steve Harvey. The time that I've spent with him and what little I know about Steve Harvey, he ain't backing down from anybody or anything. My man's not afraid of anything. And he's like, hey, man, I'm not working with this cat. What are you doing here? What do you want? But what's that say about Gronk? Getting a gig alongside Steve Harvey, who's like red hot, less than 1 year removed from football, but this is the kind of superstar ascension that he's on right now. Then there was the Super Bowl party this past month, the one that the Hood himself, Bill Belichick, attended. Again, throwing a televised Super Bowl party in Miami is not shocking at all, but having Darth Hoodie show up in board shorts and flip-flops for that same party is. So far, Gronk has had at least one major TV appearance each month to start 2020. And despite the current situation around the globe, March and April are no different. He's not showing any sign of slowing down. Because this past Friday, Gronk showed up at WWE's SmackDown to promote his WrestleMania hosting gig, which is coming up next month. Right now, with every sport on hold pretty much, WWE is forging on, and they're doing it without a crowd. Remember last week I played you some sound of Stone Cold Steve Austin cutting a promo from the ring on microphone to an empty arena, and it was weird. Hilariously weird, but weird.
If you want to know what 316 Day is all about, give me a hell yeah. I said, if you want to know what 316 Day is all about, give me a hell yeah.
If there is one single professional sport that needs the crowd more than any other, it's got to be wrestling. Performing a scripted monologue to an empty room is one step removed from practicing at home in front of the mirror. I mean, nothing about that feels or sounds or looks right. But right now, content is king. Everybody needs content. And if it's original content and fresh content, as opposed to regurgitated or repurposed content, even better. So the WWE is sacrificing optics, and they're churning out content, and Gronk is here for it. Here's his intro and his walk down the ramp Friday night at SmackDown.
For the first time ever, Rob Gronkowski!
Visualize Gronk dancing like only Gronk can in an empty building. Acting like there's 24,000 people in there. Imagine Gronk walking out, losing his mind, completely losing his mind, and dancing like an insane person and hyping up a crowd that does not exist for an entire minute. The commitment alone is worth your respect. That's what he did. He lived up to the introduction. The second thing. The hell is that song? Can I get some of that again? The hell is that? Is that the royalty-free knockoff of Party Rock by LMFAO? Listen to Gronk's walk-up music. Okay, that's Gronk's. Now listen to LMFAO. I smell a lawsuit. Dead rip, allegedly. All right, so he gets introduced. He dances for an entire minute to a bunch of fans who aren't there. He loses his mind. Now it's time for the big dog to enter the ring and cut a promo. Man, you got to sell. You got to sell, and you got to sell hard, especially if the room is empty. Here is Gronk's first attempt.
Let me tell you something. I've been watching since second grade from the nosebleeds when the WWE... will come to Buffalo, New York, my hometown. I've been watching at the arena, FCW Arena, that is, in Tampa, Florida, to support my boy, Mojo Rawley, when there was only five people in the stands. I've been to sold-out WrestleManias in front of 80,000 people, and now I'm here in front of zero people, and I'm still hype, baby!
Hey, man, you know what? I buy it. I believe him. I really do. I believe that he is still hype, baby.
And I'm still hype, baby.
Showmanship level infinity. You cannot teach that. Now the really hard part. Playing off another performer. Here's Baron Corbin telling Gronk that he expects him to bend the knee. Let's see how Gronk does here.
My name is King Corbin. And as your king, I expect it to be greeted a very certain way. I expect you to get on your knees and bow down.
Nah, we're good, man. We don't get on our knees. I'm sorry.
Let's not get into that. You know, that's passable. Hey, that's harder than it looks. Not bad. Not great. Not horrible. But you gotta imagine that if a crowd was there, it probably would have backed him up and gone nuts when he, well, effectively told off the heel. But again, there is no crowd. So it just sounds weird. None of this is going to get any less weird next month at WrestleMania 36, because WrestleMania also will not have any fans. And Gronk is going to be working that mic a lot more than he did Friday night. However, if anything can work, that can work. And here are two reasons why it can work. Number one, Gronk is still hype, baby.
And I'm still hype, baby.
That's reason number one. That's a good reason. Reason number two. It's still real to me, damn it.
It's still real to me, damn it. Thank
Make
you.
Make it easy, man.
James Bradbury is my guest. James, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Good, good. I'm great, in fact. So you were an unrestricted free agent. Let me start right there. How did you go about approaching your free agency? Was that fun? Was it interesting? Or was it just kind of stressful?
For me, it wasn't stressful. I was just being patient. The most stress was like during the season, you know, just making sure I played well and I came out injury free. I mean, free agency was pretty smooth for me because all I did was work out.
Like that makes sense, right? So you're going through the entire year and you want to make sure that you're putting the best stuff on film and you stay healthy so you're ready to hit free agency when it happens. What about the Giants? What was it about that opportunity that made you feel like that was the right place for you?
So when free agency came, you know, I had a it was either between the Lions and New York, and I just felt like New York was a better fit for me. You know, I knew Mr. Gettleman, so I know what type of organization he's trying to build over there. And I knew some of the players that were there as well, and they had nothing but good things to say about the organization. So I felt like it was the right fit.
Were there any red flags or anything about Detroit where you thought, yeah, maybe not?
Oh, no. I mean, I feel like both organizations were great. I feel like both coaches were great coaches. I just feel like New York might have been a better feel for me. You know, it's a great city. It's something new for me. You know, I'm more of an introvert. And, you know, I want to go to a big city just so I can explore a little bit more around the city.
That's interesting. James Bradbury joining us. Now, you're 4 years into your career, but you're going into a situation where you're going to be the vet among a young group of cornerbacks. What's your approach when it comes to being a leader and making sure you help raise the game of those around you as well?
Just pretty much do what veterans did for me. You know, like guys like Mike Adams and Captain Munnelin, they came in and pretty much they weren't like real boisterous with their words, but they would always give me like little tips and stuff whenever I was in practice or whenever I was watching film, and they always encouraged me. That's the one thing I want to do for my teammates, encourage them to be better. So eventually one day they can get a second contract like me.
James Bradbury joining us, and that's the key, right? You want to get to that second contract, and you want to pick guys up around you. You know, I ask you about that because you've been a starter ever since you arrived in the NFL, but one of the things that you said at the end of last season was, coming from Samford, I didn't have too much confidence. I mean, from the outside, that seems like an almost incredible thing that you didn't have that much confidence. Yet, what was that transition like then from Samford to playing in the NFC South?
It was definitely different. Because I didn't have to face guys like Julio, Mike Evans, and Michael Thomas. So it was definitely different, but it's something you had to get acclimated to, get adjusted to. And, you know, confidence just came from watching film, practicing hard, and then you start making plays, and that's when you get more confidence each and every year.
All right, so to that point you just made, you didn't run into guys like that in college. So last season playing in the South, you went up against Michael Thomas, Julio Jones, and Mike Evans, and you only allowed one touchdown in six games. Those are three of the best in the game. How much did you enjoy and look forward to those battles?
While I was in the conference, it was kind of stressful. So I didn't really look forward to those battles.
Okay.
But, you know, I always approach those battles just with a different mindset. You know, I knew I wanted to go out there and dominate and I wanted to make plays. But now that I'm not in that conference anymore, I feel like I'm going to miss it. You know, I used to get up early for those games because it was just a big battle for me and it was a test. And as a competitor, that's all you can ask for is to go against the best.
James Bradbury is a member of the Giants now. I would imagine each of those three guys are going to have their own approach and their own strengths on the field. Like when you're facing Julio, for example, what are the keys for you when it comes to shutting him down or slowing him down?
So one, you know, when you get the play call, you know, you want to make sure you play to your hilt. Like if you're in cover three or whatnot, if you're a man, just know you got that post safety help, so you don't really have to guard the post. But, you know, you want to get hands on him and be physical with him. I mean, you just want to switch it up. You know, you want to play a little bit off. You want to bail sometimes, and you want to press. You know, you can't always just do the same thing because eventually they're going to catch on to that, and then they're going to hurt you by using your strength against you.
You know, your journey really is amazing. It's not just a matter of you coming from Samford and going to the NFL. You had built your name in this league, but if we go back even further than that, when you were at Pleasant Grove High School in Alabama, you weren't even the biggest star on that team. The story goes that most of the attention from college recruiters went to a running back named Anthony Gardner. So what were you like as a high school player?
Like you said, AG was that's still my friend to this day. He's a close friend of mine. I call him AG. So AG was he was the guy for our team. You know, he pretty much did everything. He was our running back, and he held that offense down. And he ended up getting injured, I think, like halfway through the year. And then the coach actually asked me to come over to offense and start picking up some offensive plays. And I felt like that's when I started getting more attention from schools because I started showing my versatility. And like you said, man, I was the second guy until he ended up getting injured, and it pushed me into the forefront.
All right, so then you go to Arkansas State, and then you transfer to Samford, where you played really, really well. If I told you back in high school that you would be a shutdown corner in the NFL and one of the most sought-after players in free agency, what would you have said then? Like, would you have been surprised, or is this pretty much the way it was going to go according to plan?
I probably would have laughed at you until you get out of my face. I mean, because at the time, I wasn't really a sought-after recruit. So, I mean, being in the NFL and being a big-time cornerback, I didn't really think that could happen at the time.
Talking James Bradbury, you know, last time you and I spoke, we talked a little about your time at Samford. And let me ask you this then. What did you take away from that experience? And then how much does it mean to you to be representing Samford at the next level?
So for me, Samford was more than football. You know, it's a great school, a great academic school. That was one of the reasons why I chose to go there. So I told my mom I wanted to, you know, I was going to get my four-year degree. And I just wanted to make a good living for myself. So Samford, it instilled faith in me, also work ethic in the classroom, responsibilities. It's a lot. You know, it means a lot to represent Samford just because there's so many players that's in the league now that comes from Samford. And I feel like we started something special. You know, we had Corey White, we had Courtland Finnegan, and now it's me, Nick Williams, Shaquaski Tart, Michael Pierce. You know, it's quite a few of us in the league now, so it means a lot.
It may or may not surprise you, but when you run down that list, and there's a lot of really, really good players on that list and some really interesting guys, the guy that I go right to, though, Courtland Finnegan. James, man, that's one of my favorite guys. I love Courtland Finnegan. How would you describe him as a person and as a player? What'd you make of his game and his swagger?
So as a player, man, I just know he's a feisty competitor, you know, always willing to step up to that test, to that battle, you know. Everybody remembers the fight with Andre Johnson, you know. So you know he's feisty. He's going to try to get after you. And he's a talented guy, you know. I feel like that overshadowed his play. And he was a great cornerback, Pro Bowl guy. I think he was all pro as well, was he not?
I believe he was.
Yeah, so he was a great cornerback. And I met him one time when he came to Samford. He seemed like a real laid-back dude, real cool. I hate I missed him when he came to Carolina because I came after he played here. But I've heard nothing but good things about it.
That's a great description. And utterly fearless, obviously. This guy was never, ever, ever going to back down. Listen, before you go, you mentioned work ethic. It's such an unusual offseason. How do you go about preparing for next season during what this is, you know, an offseason that we've never seen before?
So right now I'm working out because they haven't really shut down the city of Charlotte. So they have a few gyms open, so I'm still working out. But I know eventually they're going to shut everything down. So I'm going to figure out something. And I reached out to a couple of companies on Instagram to see if they can send me some equipment because everything's ordered up. You know, I went online, I went on Rogue Fitness, and everything was pretty much ordered up, you know, out of stock. I'm going to figure out something in the next couple weeks.
I got it. I know you will, but it's so true, right? Everything is ordered. James Bradbury, New York Giants cornerback, signed with the Giants last week. He was the 62nd pick overall in 2016. Congrats on that deal, James. Great to run you down. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you.
Good night.